I wanted to start by talking a bit about what it was like for you at Oxford, because I meet student journalists now and I think these people are scarily driven. Was that you?
No. God, no. I wasn't scarily anything. I remember arriving in Oxford and thinking, well, I'd quite like to write some stuff. So I went to a meeting at Charwell, and there were some very efficient-looking people around, and someone said, do you want to do a story about marijuana? I thought, all right. Which involved going to Lady Margaret Hall and asking the principal, are there a lot of people taking it?
And were there?
And she said no, which I wrote in. And I went back and gave it into the news editor. And he said, that's not a story. Nor was it true in any sense. So that was my initial Oxford student journalism. But essentially what I did here was I thought, well, here's an opportunity to try and be funny. And there was a magazine which had been started called Passing Wind, which is a very mature title, which made it very difficult to get any advertising. You know, you go to the nice clothes shops in the high street. Do you want a full page? Well, I might. What's the title of your publication? It's called Passing Wind. Get out. But anyway, so I took over this magazine, which became a satirical magazine, and I had to put up £400, but fortunately my tutorial partner was an Old Etonian, and at that point I thought the only point of Old Etonians was to give you money, which he did. So I bought the debts of this magazine, and I started it and attempted to be funny.
The way that you met Richard Ingrams, who was the previous editor of Private Eye, was by interviewing him in 1980 for Passing Wind. I went and looked up the questions you asked him on the basis I thought I could just probably steal them. Do you think journalism is a bitchy world?
Yes, if done well.
I particularly appreciate this one. You haven't changed the format in a very long time. Do you feel it's becoming stale, as some people claim?
Given that I haven't changed it myself for 30 years, that was a very good question.
And do you know for certain that Reginald Bosanquet wears a wig?
Yes, I was very interested in that at that age.
Do you know what? I think we could probably update that with, is there perhaps another figure who the subject of their hair in a similar way? But let's maybe not go there. You were at Oxford at the same time as Philip Geddes.
Yes.
Did you know him?
Yes, I knew him just a little, and my friend Chris, who's here tonight, used to share digs with him at one point in London when they first moved there. He just appeared to be so much further ahead than everyone. And to be honest, we were rather jealous. I think I was still working in London as a tutor. I was doing, retakes for people who'd been thrown out of their public schools for smoking. And Phil had a job, and he was a proper journalist, and he was on the Standard, and he was on the Express, so he was rather an extraordinary figure, and it was very shocking, and when he died, it was exactly as though it had been written, for a young journalist to hang around to see if there was a story there, to make sure he was there, and then the bomb goes off after the threat. It is difficult to talk to younger journalists. I mean, yes, that there's the tube bombings and whatever now, but London was sort of high alert then, and RSs were, off Oxford Street, and there did seem to be a risk, and it was a risk that he clearly took. So when you asked me to do this, it's a long, long time ago, but it's still extraordinary to think he was 24, all that bit of life he wouldn't get.
And what at the time did you think that a career in journalism involved in the early 80s?
Oh, lunch. No, I in the early 80s, it did seem like anything was possible. All sorts of magazines were setting up. Time Out was being set up. I mean, I went into Time Out's office, which was in Covent Garden, and there was a literary editor there called Steve Grant. And I said, can I review some books? And he said, have you read any? And I said, yeah, a few, and he said, all right. That was it. Which is it's not what young journalists want to hear now, because now you have to speak seven languages and interned at, you know, NASA. And if you haven't got that on your CV, no one looks at you. But fortunately, in our day, you could get opportunities. And it was very exciting.
One of my favourite pieces of Private Eye lore is the fact you became editor when you were 26.
I did, yes.
And it sort of happened at the end of a boozy lunch. And then there was almost immediately an attempted coup, sort of Erdogan-style coup against you.
There was. It wasn't an Erdogan coup. It was more a sort of Labour Party coup, i.e. pathetic and failed. A number of the middle-aged journalists at Private Eye were furious that I'd been given this job. You know, and as I get older, I sympathise with them. Must have been fantastically annoying. And they made the mistake of taking the Private Eye proprietor, Peter Cook, out to lunch, not realising that, you know, Peter didn't eat, really. His idea of lunch was more liquid. And so they filled him up with booze, and he came back at the end of lunch, and he saw me in the office, and I said, "How did it go?" And he said, "Welcome aboard." That was the coup. So afterwards, I sacked them. It just doesn't seem terribly callous, does it? And Peter Mackay, Nigel Dempster, these sort of figures.
I'm familiar with their work.
Anyway, they had to go. And obviously, I've forgiven them since. Largely because they're dead. Except Mackay. Anyway, yes, so we had a bit of a clear out.
It reminds me, when I was at the Daily Mail, we ran a headline that said, Princess Diana's privacy was invaded again and again by Peter Mackay and Richard Kay. And you thought, well, yes, that is an accurate description of what happened. One of the talking about feuds, you hated Piers Morgan before it was fashionable. You're kind of a Piers Morgan hipster.
Yes, I'm an early adopter in terms of hatred.
But is what he represents, so I kind of tend to think of it as the kind of the trollumist, right? Somebody who just writes a column just to sort of wind people up. Is that a new thing, or was that around when you started?
No, that was always there. They've always been the sort of Katie Hopkins equivalents of people who wanted to be noticed. I mean, they couldn't do it through social media then. You couldn't count how annoying you were. You had to sort of do it anecdotally. My problem with Piers, they came through real journalism. I mean, it was about, if you remember, when he was editor of The Mirror, he was buying shares in companies that his city desk was tipping. You know, even if you're ethically challenged, that is not appropriate behaviour by the editor. So Private Eye ran this story, and it was in Vigeland shares. Mm-hmm. And Piers got very, very cross, and he decided that he would put a whole team of Mirror people just on me to turn me over. I mean, it was huge resources, a lot of money and a lot of journalists. And I was living in Kent, and he just sent people down to my village. And forgive me for telling this story, but they were all over the village asking questions, and I got a call from my vicar. He said, "I've just had someone from the Mirror on the phone." And I said, "I'm terribly sorry." And he said, "They wanted to know whether you'd confessed anything juicy." And I had to explain to the Mirror that in the C of E, we do not have confession. Which I thought was a terrible faux pas.
And who was it who sent Benji the binman to go through the Private Eye bins? Was another one of your feuds?
Oh, well, this was Mohammed El Fayed, who, again, Private Eye had a number of feuds with over the years. And it came about that he was going through our bins because I wrote, as I often do, a rude letter to one of the journalists, saying, you know, this piece is rubbish, I want something better than this. And usually, I think better of it, and then I throw that letter away. And then say, "Lovely try, sorry, there wasn't room." But my letter to this journalist appeared in Punch, which Mohammed El Fayed then owned. So I thought, there's only one way you've got that letter, and you've gone through our bins. So we put a camera outside. And we found he'd employed this man called Benji the Bin Man, who was a very strange figure. Not really investigative journalism at its finest. And he used to just go round Soho nicking people's bins. And he took them home to his mum's house in North London. And he had a whole garden full of plastic bins. And it was sort of crawling, and there were rats. really revolting. And then he'd go through and he produced extraordinary stories. So that was the bins.
But when I was reading that and I thought about him, I thought about James Goldsmith, Robert Maxwell, you know, one of the ways that Private Eye has excelled is by taking on those big bullies, essentially. Who are the big bullies of today that you've got in your sights?
Well, there's the world's biggest, isn't there? I mean, they're the same sort of bunch. I mean, there's Aaron Banks is out there. He's pretty bullying. Rupert Murdoch's very annoying because he never takes any action. I mean, that's what satirists hate most. If someone says, you know, you're appalling, pathetic, juvenile, jumped-up public school twat, you should be killed, that's very pleasing. If someone says, oh, well, who cares, that's really hurtful. And Rupert Murdoch knows that. So it's very, very difficult to get under his skin. So, I mean, in terms of the grand bullies, the male, they're quite sensitive flowers, as you probably remember. I mean, they run enemies of the people about anyone, but if you say that wasn't a very good piece, they all weep in a corridor and say, oh, leave us alone. I can't imagine how you survived there.
Well, I spent 4 years on the subs desk, so I was protected by a pretty, you know, decent chief sub. And then I went to the features desk, and that was the point at which it all became clear that I was not long for the male world. I was summoned into Dacre's office, and he likes to have everything printed out for him and double-spaced in 12-point font. And when they updated the commuter system, they had to make it so this was the default printer setting for everything, so lest anyone accidentally sent him anything single-spaced, which obviously would have probably burst a blood vessel. And I went in with some piece about, I think it was Arnold Kursler, and he said, this piece is lip-smackingly vulgar. And you stood there and you thought, well, how do I say to him, but I thought you liked that? And I think that was probably the point at which I thought, I'm not sure that we're going to get along for a long time. But he was very sad when I left. He said, you know, because I wrote a column that was slightly mean about him, and he said, why is your girl slagging me off? And it is an astonishing figure. There's a great phrase called a mimophant, which is somebody who has the skin of an elephant when they're attacking someone else, but the delicate skin of a mimosa when they themselves are kind of attacked. And I think those, like you say, those are the funnest people to poke.
Well, Trump is absolutely marvellous at that. You know, the idea that you're president of the United States and your Saturday evenings, you're watching Saturday Night Live and going, this isn't funny. Has he got nothing else to do?
I wanted to talk to you about cancel subscriptions, talking about people who get very cross.
Yes.
You know, we had a few cancel subscriptions when the New Statesman said that we perhaps didn't think that Jeremy Corbyn was the left-wing messiah that the world had been waiting for.
Blairite scum.
We should join the Tories, etc., etc. But, I mean, what are the things that actually make people cancel their subscriptions as opposed to send you letters saying they're going to?
Well, we've had a real sort of tidal wave of it the last couple of years, and I do think it's... I mean, they're from different groups of people, but essentially for the same reasons. Firstly, it was from the UKIPers, then it was from the SNPers, then it was from younger people who discovered Corbyn. And all of them shared, essentially... a lack of history in politics. They'd never been very interested before, but something had got them involved. So they got heavily involved in politics, but only in the politics that they agreed with and that other people would reinforce. So when this politics comes up against any sort of criticism, they get very, very angry. So the UKIPers who, you know, discovered the idea of sovereignty, you know, most of these people don't have sovereignty over their family or their wives. But they discovered it as an idea, or they discovered immigration as an idea. If you challenged that, they were very, very cross. And they said, well, what's wrong with you? Why don't you share my opinion? And the same happened with the Corbynites, young people saying, what is the matter with you? I do not understand why you don't share all my opinions. And if you don't share all my opinions, why don't you shut up? And it was at this point you were saying, well, that isn't really how it works. You see, you're meant to have an opinion, and then I can give an opinion or criticise that, and then we have a dialogue. But rather like the SNP trollers, that's it. If you're English and you don't agree with them, you are essentially imperialist and on the wrong side. And if you're Scottish and you don't agree with them, you're a traitor. That's it. That's the argument. And those sets of sort of clashing single beliefs led to a lot of people, a lot of I readers, just writing to us saying, we cancel our subscriptions. And they were very, very cross. I mean, there was sort of a vicar wrote to me saying, you know, if I lived a bit closer to your office, I'd come round and shove your opinions up your arse till they came out your mouth.
What would Jesus have said?
The Reverend Foster.
But, I mean, so...
There was another vicar. A lot of vicars in my talk tonight. There was another vicar who said, look, we've had a referendum. People have voted. You must respect the will of the majority. And I said, well, that's a bit rich, coming from a church that was founded with a minority of 12. And then I added, actually, on Good Friday, it was a minority of 1. He didn't write back. So, no, there's some people get very, very cross, and if you won't stop saying the thing you believe, or you won't stop analysing the situation, they get furious. And I think this is a sort of... This is a more recent trend.
But how much do you feel now that you're swimming against the tide? Because it's a kind of easy thing of saying, well, actually, you've been around so long that you've kind of carved out that role for yourself. I'm trying to think of 1997, when Princess Diana died.
Yeah.
And you did that front page that said, what was it? The papers of disgrace. Yes, I couldn't get one anywhere. Borrow mine. It's got a picture of the car. And everyone else
you see,
had...
Tumbleweed.
Which I think is a great joke. But anyway, everyone else had Queen of All Our Hearts.
Yes.
And people refused to stock you. You must have felt very lonely then, as a publication.
Yes, and I mean, she died, I think, at the weekend, and we went to press on Monday, and literally, I had to decide what I thought in a day. But actually, at the time, it didn't seem difficult to formulate. And afterwards, people said, well, this is, you know, this is very, very stupid. I mean, you can satirise everyone, but you don't attack the general public for hypocrisy, because they're going to buy the paper. But it was the most colossal week of humbug in my life. There were people who literally on the Friday were writing pieces saying, what is this woman doing swanning around the Mediterranean with some Arab playboy? Why don't she look after our kids? On the Tuesday morning, Diana, Princess of Our Hearts... We will miss her commitment, her lovely boys. He thought, this is nauseating. Absolutely nauseating. And it was Fleet Street at its worst. But it was also spread out. And there was sort of, there was grief hysteria. How upset are you about Diana? Well, sort of moderately, bastard. You know, do you have no feelings? And a man come on the radio saying, well, my wife died last year of cancer, but I mean, that was nothing compared to Diana dying. And he thought, well, you need help. I mean, you don't need to go and put flowers down. You need professional counselling.
But do you think there are any subjects that people feel that strongly about today? I mean, I feel a whisper of it with Brexit, with this sort of... the anger of people who have won. That's the thing I never really foresaw in the Brexit referendum. People whose side won
yeah.
are furious about it.
Well, it's true in Brexit and it's true in the States as well. The people who are really cross are the people who won. Which I, as a psychologist, would describe to guilt.
I'm talking about this idea of getting into trouble. I write a lot of feminist articles, and the two subjects that most reliably get me into trouble are saying that selling sex is actually exploitative, not empowering. This is now a very controversial opinion, and also that perhaps not all 8-year-olds who say that they want to wear a dress are actually transgender. And those are two things that, if you're on the left and you're a feminist, are incredibly controversial. What are the things that get you in trouble now? What are your opinions that most provoke outrage?
I mean, it is the one I've just expressed, suggesting that I'm not entirely convinced that leaving the EU is a brilliant idea. That gets people very, very cross. Saying that you think some people voted for Trump not out of a sense of deep alienation and a failure of globalisation, but because they're quite unpleasant. And they responded to something unpleasant in him. That doesn't work very well. Jokes generally about subjects that are considered rather like what I mean, yours is very specific, and you have to be much more careful, I think. But in any issue, I mean, I will get letters saying you should not make jokes about suicide. I mean, nearly all cartoonists who live and work on their own in rooms looking out the window, I mean, most of their jokes are about topping themselves. So we get a lot of those, and people say, that's not funny, and these issues are not funny. I mean, I just favourite validation of my theory that you should be able to laugh at anything, and anything grim. I mean, it is both a release and a way of defying it, is to make jokes about it. We ran one of my favourite cartoons, which was about the bipolar Grand Old Duke of York. When he was up, he was up. When he was down, he was down. I thought this was very funny. Anyway, a number of people wrote in objecting, and then one of our readers sent in the most fabulous letter, and it said, "Dear sir, I saw your cartoon about the bipolar Grand Old Duke of York. I suffer from this condition, and I saw the cartoon, and I thought it was absolutely disgraceful. I looked at it again a few days later, thought it was really funny." See, that's the quality of our readers.
But I wonder if this is a reason for Private Eye success. I mean, I was looking up your circulation, which frankly makes me feel pathetically inadequate. 287,000, the highest in 55 years in the last ABCs. Do you think that you've become a sort of refuge from a world where you're being told to be perpetually outraged about everything? People feel a sense of relief that, like, there's still a place where we can find terrible stuff funny.
Yes, I think that's right. And I think in the last year or two, to be able to say, well, it's not just scary. I mean, you know, sort of people on campuses having therapy because Trump's been elected. You know, there's got to be a better way. And there's certainly a way that annoys him more, which is to laugh at it. I mean, our circulation, I think a lot of people have had a good year in terms of circulation because events have driven people away from fake news and towards sites. I mean, this is funny coming from Private Eye. Sites that they will believe. And print still has that authority. Partly because in print, if you say something and you get it wrong, you get into trouble. On the whole, you don't online. Yeah. If we get something wrong, there will be, you know, a reckoning.
My editor keeps saying to me, you know, Trump's fantastic for journalists. And I say, up until the point we get put in sort of detention centres.
Yes.
And then probably not so much after that. But you're right. I mean, the kind of quality news market has had an enormous bounce off that, because I think people sort of do feel that this world is kind of just completely chaotic, and they want more people to tell them, who they trust, to tell them what's happening.
And, you know, if you have a president who basically, I mean, we had a joke of him on the cover at a press conference saying, you know, freedom of the press, ask me anything I like. and that's about it. And it's not just he doesn't like opinions, he doesn't like facts. I mean, I have never seen a political figure who literally reverses his opinion in the middle of a sentence. He doesn't even wait till the end of what he's just said. I mean, it is absolutely extraordinary. And I think in reaction to that, people want to be told what the facts are, the real facts.
But doesn't it make doing jokes harder?
People say this. Well, I mean, no. I have to admit, I mean, Trump being around makes jokes much, much easier. I mean, last week, you know, we sit down and decide what are we going to put on the cover. And there were 10 good Trump jokes. I think I put 5 of them on the cover. I mean, it's literally, you just chuck them all on. You know, in a normal week, you'd be thinking, how amusing is Theresa May? Not hugely. Farage? Yes, yes. But so, no, it's, you know, it does make it easier. What makes it harder is to do the things that will annoy and illuminate in ways that went off. So rather than, like, you know, on the Trump marches, the banners that were funny were the ones you remember. There were millions of students with, you know, banners saying, fuck Trump. Yeah. But the ones that said, free Melania, now, that was funny.
There were some magnificent... I mean, yeah, anyway, but we...
And that's the way in. And in America, I mean, I think the satire's there. The ones who've suggested that he will run America like one of his businesses and therefore bankrupt it, they really annoy him. It's suggesting he's useless at the things he boasts about. That is the way in. And the fact that he doesn't know anything about the Rust Belt and he isn't in contact with these people, all of that infuriates him. And the Russian story is fabulous because he cannot get away from it. It keeps turning up.
But one of the things you mentioned earlier is that idea that you get told, you know, if you're a Scottish nationalist, that you're not allowed to have an opinion on this as an English person. This definitely, I get this all the time. You know, that we are the liberal elite. I'm sure probably everyone in this room, by definition of being in this room, is probably a member of the liberal elite.
Well, for me, it depends which week it is. You know, if I go through the below the line or the duty long of have I got news for week? I got news for you. You know, one week I am smug Tory boy wanker, and the next week I'm liberal metropolitan elite. I don't know which. I'm terribly split.
But do you think the idea of an elite is actually useful anymore?
No. And again, I think it is funny that the champions of the common people against the elite turn out to be Trump, you know, who's an inherited billionaire who lives in New York. He lives on one of the coasts. He has had no contact at all with anyone who does any sort of recognisable work in his whole life, apart from East Europeans. services in the flats, honestly. And Farage, you know, he went to Dulwich Prep and then worked in the city as a commodities trader. Wow, that's working class as you get. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, I did feel that last year was the story of people who had more money than me telling me I was elite.
Yes.
I felt it was really cruel. That I felt as if I was going to be called elite, I at least wanted to have a big house in France out of it.
And have something to show for it.
Yeah.
I mean, and Farage demanding a knighthood in order to sock it to the elite. He'd like to become Sir Nigel. I mean, it is very, very funny. And it is that dichotomy that I think you just mustn't suck it up, as it were. And this is what I'm told all the time. You know, you lost, suck it up, get over it. Ooh, God. Stop moaning. It's terribly pleasing just to ignore that and to carry on moaning and say it's not over. This sort of paraphrasing the entire debate into, you know, this is the liberal elite. It's not very helpful.
No, it doesn't really take you anywhere, because then it becomes an argument about who's got a right to have an opinion. And I thought the whole point of democracy was that everybody had a right to have an opinion.
Yeah.
Talking of everybody having the right to have an opinion, see that segue, the internet.
She is brilliant.
Yes. Like Michael Parkinson in his prime, this. The internet. You're not a massive fan of the internet, I think it's fair to say, unless you're secretly on eBay at all hours of the night.
No, I'm not. I was going to say I Instagrammed my lunch today, but I didn't. No,
but,
I'm not.
But
I'm not a huge fan,
aren't you? Because there is the tax haven stuff on the website. I mean, I think you once said that, you know, Canard Enchaîné, the French version of Private Eye, that's as well, sort of as is, has a website that basically just says "F off and buy the magazine."
Yes, they're brilliant. they are absolutely resolute. You go there and it is just a sort of almost a handwritten sign saying, go and buy the magazine. And if I was bolder, I would just do that. I mean, we have a small presence, which are essentially are teasers and are small things to say, go and buy the magazine. Because the internet model, I've been saying this for, you know, 20 years, does not work for print. Giving away content, A, it seemed to me mad, and B, seem to be lacking the confidence in your own craft. I mean, I believe journalism is sort of quite difficult to do well, and the people who do it well should be paid, and the ones who do it very well have to be paid quite a bit. I want to be able to do that so that the magazine that I produce will be entertaining and interesting and informative, and all of that costs money. So Private Eye costs £1.80, which is nothing. You know, it's most people I see passing the window are paying £2.30 every day for a cup of coffee. Mm. I'm employing, you know, 20 journalists and probably 50 contributors for that. You know, this is madness. And I believe in print. I think cartoonists look brilliant with pen and ink and with drawn, and the pleasure you get from seeing that on the page is vast. So I've invested money in having more cartoonists. I've paid more to journalists. I mean, these are all things that people think I'm completely crazy. But all of this, I think, bears fruit because our readers acknowledge that giving away content for free, people will not then pay for it. You can't turn the clock back.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting that magazines are doing relatively well at a time when newspapers aren't, actually, because you know, The Independent no longer has a print edition, The Guardian's burning through its reserves faster than a man with a can of petrol. The Telegraph's been kind of asset-stripped, really. I'm sure we'll probably have to cut that out from the video.
No, let's put that bit in. The Telegraph, you know, the newspaper makes quite a substantial amount of money, sort of 50, 60 million pounds. I mean, there is money in journalism. That's not nothing as a business model. And if you take it all out again, then it doesn't work so well. I think print journalism has been very, very underconfident. It's been overwhelmed by the digital world. And we were all told at all points, digital advertising will come in and cover all the costs. And it doesn't. No one has managed to make any money out of digital advertising. You know, the people you're aiming at, the younger generation, A, they're too clever, they use ad blockers anyway, or they work their way round it. They don't care. And they don't want to see ads. Fine.
Yeah, no one wants to see it. That's one of the things I always think about with ours, is that actually basically you're trying to give people a product that they actively don't want. You're trying to actively making your site more unpleasant to visit. But anyway, we must go to questions. I have one final question before we go.
Can I just say our advertisers are marvellous? If you want bespoke suits from Raj, they're very, very good. Thank you. And there's some excellent T-shirts.
I like the ones where about you go on a cruise with people and sort of around Etruscan pottery. I always think that's why I was planning
to. They look really good, don't they?
Yeah, so thumbs up for that.
Yeah, no.
What was your best and your worst day in your time as editor at Private Eye?
My best day was winning a court case, which was fabulous because I have fought 40 libel actions, and I've won one. Which is a pretty impressive record. We won against, there's a particular libel firm called Peter Carter Ruck and Partners, who, due to the poor technology at the Private Eye, always appear in print as Peter Carter Fuck. They've sued us a lot over the years. Actually, Peter Carteret was a very distinguished old lawyer. He rang me once and he said, "You are pathetic." He said, "I do not want to appear in your pitiful rag as Peter Carterfuck." I said, "Absolutely, Peter, it won't happen again." So the next issue, he was Peter Fartercuck. It's pretty grown-up stuff at Private Eye. Anyway, we finally won a court case against them.
Oh.
And they had to pay all the costs, and we won, and it was terrific. So that, I felt marvellous. The worst day, the diner time was pretty bad, because we weren't on sale anywhere. Mm. There's been twice the magazine has been totally removed from the shelves, once then, and once by Robert Maxwell. And I genuinely thought, I've bankrupted the magazine. Have we got 5 minutes? I mean, just a small story about Peter Cook, who was the proprietor of Private Eye. Robert Maxwell had got Private Eye removed from the shelves, and he'd set up a publication on the Daily Mirror presses called Not Private Eye, and he was going to print 1 million copies of this to sort of flood it and basically remove us. And Peter Cook, who owned Private Eye, brilliant, proprietor and comic, Peter arrived in the office. We were all unbelievably gloomy, and I thought, I've totally messed this job up. Peter said, I bet they hate having to produce a magazine attacking Private Eye. Let's send them over a crate of whiskey. So we sent over a crate of whiskey to the Mirror. We waited about 2 hours, and Peter said, they'll all be pissed now. And I said, are you sure? And he said, yeah. So we went in a taxi, Peter, my secretary, the MD of the Eye. We went to the Mirror building. Peter was incredibly famous, so we just went through the door. Doorman said, oh, Peter Cook, he's here. Look, he's on the telly. And we went up to the top floor, 15th floor, Maxwell's office, where they were putting together the dummy of Not Private Eye. And they were all pissed. Absolutely true. We went in the door, said, hello, we're here. The dummy was there on the table. So I took it and I put it under my coat. And I said, let's go. But Peter wasn't happy. He said, well, no, I mean, this is marvellous. So he ordered champagne from Mirror Catering, which arrived. He got the Mirror photo desk to come and picture us in Maxwell's office. He got a crayon and wrote, hello, Captain Bob, on the window. And then we rang New York, which is where Maxwell was. And Peter rang and he said, can I speak to Rob Maxwell? And they said, no. And Peter said, can you tell him we're in his office? And then Maxwell called security from New York and we were thrown out. But I had the dummy. So we went to W.H. Smith's and said, you've taken us off the shelves. This is much more libelous. And we've got it. We'll do a deal. Put us back on the shelves and we'll take no action over this dummy. And then we were back on the shelves. So it was like the Guns of Navarone, except with Peter Cook leading in a slightly lurchy fashion. But anyway, that was probably the lowest point, because I thought I'd completely messed up forever. But the highest point, because it was just a brilliant day.
You got free champagne.
Free champagne.
And prank called
and
Robert
I sat
Batter.
In Captain Bob's office.
Okay. Well, let's take some questions from the audience. I think we've got some microphones maybe to go around. Yeah, that's probably a good note to end on. I'll hand over to Keith, but for a moment, please say thank you very much to Ian Hazard.
Thank you.